Good morning and welcome to this Monday, the 25th of March. It's our roundtable on the roundtable. Hope you all had a good weekend. And not only do I mean that to you listeners at home, but I mean that to the people in this room as well.
We love you, Charles.
Good morning.
This is a very strange buzz in the room this morning.
Yeah.
Well, we're going to try to alleviate that.
Oh, good.
Because we have some great topics.
Although
and some really cool things.
Although fist fights are always
things.
Fun.
Yeah.
Well, no fist fights. I mean,
jeez.
Are they always fun, Rosemary? Is that true? Are they always fun? As you may know, we've been switching things up on the roundtable. Each day we start off with an open discussion of issues in the news and beyond. It's our roundtable on the roundtable. Joining us for the discussion this morning, Morning Edition host David Gustina, our newsman Ray Graff, and University at Albany journalism professor and investigative reporter Rosemary Armeo joined us this morning, and our news director Ian Pickus will join us later on. So thank you very much all for being with us. We're going to start by taking a look at a story which is really dominating headlines this morning for what is going to be happening tomorrow, and that is the legal battle over gay marriage, which began in a Massachusetts courthouse more than a decade ago, arrives at the Supreme Court with the court scheduled to hear two cases that could dramatically reshape the debate. The oral arguments before the nine justices, likely to be the most closely watched of the term, come as public support for gay marriage is at an all-time high, that according to recent polls. And it's so interesting to have, I mean, we think of these key cases. Of course, we had this for healthcare reform. We see it now where these are cases that are being very, very closely watched. Mm-hmm. What do you think? Because we don't really know. We have a sense. We have a sense. We have a conservative court. We have perhaps two swing votes that could make or break this. It's going to be interesting to see what happens.
I just so have the feeling that it's decided. It's almost what the court does is irrelevant, because if they don't
come
to...
In what way are they going to decide?
That's what I'm saying. I think they'll vote in favor of it. But even if they don't, it's just coming. The change in how Americans have felt about this issue over the past 10 years is just striking.
But as I understand this, now what they're going to decide is not the be-all, end-all. In other words, it's basically a financial arrangement as far as collecting federal benefits, if I have it correct.
Well, there's actually two cases coming up, and they can decide. The one from New York is whether gay couples can have the same federal benefits as a man and woman couple. But they also could make a decision in their other case and decide that across the country, you have the right to gay marriage, which is not the case right now.
Which is basically taking a look at California's Prop
Correct.
8 and putting a microscope on that case.
But who knows, sir? I'm sorry.
No, I was just going to say, but if they make that decision across the country, the states can still vote not to,
exactly.
to buy in.
Exactly. And the court could just decide, okay, no, we don't really have jurisdiction. We can't decide this at all. That's possible.
You sure?
Well.
I thought there was a story about this in Morning Edition this morning, a lengthy story. And the reporter who was covering it, I thought, made an interesting point that there are those, of course, who are very strongly in support of this issue. There are those who are very strongly against this issue. Most Americans find themselves in the middle and wavering. But what we find about those people is they tend to side more. This is just in public opinion, obviously not in the court, but in public opinion, they tend to side with where the polls go. So if we see, as the momentum switches and we see America starting to embrace this idea more and more and more, that undecided, if you will, becomes somewhat decided, which I think is interesting.
You know, on a side note, it's certainly interesting that Karl Rove said, that he could imagine a GOP presidential candidate supporting gay marriage. So if we're looking at the Republicans and them looking at the polls, and to hear Karl Rove say something like that, I thought was quite interesting.
David and I were looking at these numbers before, and you're right, Joe, they depend on what question is asked and the age of it. But overwhelmingly, there is a shift. And young people, both parties, no matter who or where, young people are so pro-gay marriage that it's just made a striking difference.
But don't you think the Republican, I mean, what Karl Rove is saying is, listen, we'll do what we can to be elected regardless.
Yeah, it's like immigration, don't you think? It's like immigration. We didn't want that, but, oh, maybe now we need it. Yeah.
And, but also, right, you need it. But also, again, this is a point that was brought out during this this Morning Edition piece, which was, yeah, but you know what we're seeing is that more and more senators, more and more congressmen have children who are gay. They're being brought into the spotlight, and it is becoming, it is, since it is not as taboo as it once was, while still difficult for many gay Americans to come out, and certainly don't want to underplay that by any stretch of the imagination. However, with more and more people and more effort on making it accepted, we're seeing that the very lawmakers who have put their foot down and said, you know, this is something that we would never allow, are suddenly personally involved in the issue. And that's a fascinating evolution.
Getting back to the Supreme Court for just one second, the interesting thing I see in this is that, you know, who is actually defending Defense of Marriage Act? It's not the federal government. Obama administration made the call a year or more ago saying, listen, we don't believe it's constitutional. We won't defend it. And I think with the Prop 8, I think California did the same thing.
They're not defending, right?
So these are interesting cases just on that alone.
Clinton, Clinton, who signed it, also disavowed
it. That's right.
And said it was a mistake. So it is interesting. The other interesting thing to me on this is, aside from the debate itself, how this turns out, you're opening up a whole new conversation on marriage. If gay marriage is okay or is eventually going to be okay, then how about polygamy? Or how about three people in a marriage? Unitarians, they're always ahead of all of us. They talk about these things, and they're looking at that. What does marriage really mean if you stop the man-woman barrier?
Don't you think, though, that there has been such a fight and there has been such now, people will argue and say, look, it has been, in comparison to other civil rights fights, this has been certainly a has moved on a fast track. However, it was still very much a fight. And, you know, I think that we often talk about this, well, yes, but then where does this stop? And then where are we going to talk about this and what about that? And but I think if most people look at this as a single issue and say, okay, well, I have, you know, my son, my nephew, my brother, my sister is gay, and I want them to have
happiness
and be able to and to not only enjoy that institution of marriage, but also all of the benefits that brings.
Again, I think it comes down to a financial. It's more of a financial situation rather, because I mean, being married doesn't necessarily equate to instant happiness. Okay, and so I'm not speaking from personal experience, but federal benefits, that's a more quantifiable situation.
Well, absolutely, but you know, regardless of what your situation is, whether you are a heterosexual couple or whether you are a gay couple, to be a gay couple and say, okay, well, you can't do this simply because you're a gay couple, you know, that brings into it, yes, there is the financial side to it, but there is also the social and cultural side allowing it to.
And to Ray's point, they had Libby Post, who's openly gay, who's been on our airwaves as a commentator over the years and has fought for gay rights, talking about inheritance and saying, you know, if I want to give my money to my partner, mm-hmm. I'm going to get taxed on it, as opposed to a married couple who does the same thing.
Yeah.
And do you think, and I'm going to put the cart before the horse here, but just because I find it interesting, if this passes in the Supreme Court and we see this title shift, do you think the states will just, there will be just a rush?
No.
Or do you still think it'll be slow?
Depends on the state.
It's almost been a rush. I was shocked that there were, two states in this last election. I think there will be more. But no, I don't think it'll be a rush. I think there'll be hangout. There's still significant portions of the population who are opposed to this. And Republican majorities are still, in many places, very much opposed to it. It just won't be as important now because you can just travel to another state.
Like the electoral map, I'd like to see it, how it all plays out. You know?
Well, absolutely. And, you know, there was a fascinating article, and I unfortunately don't remember. I flagged it, but I didn't print it out, that I found really interesting was that there is one town in the United States, and I want to say it's in Oklahoma, but I'm not positive, where, according to the U.S. Senate, it was the only place, according to the census, where there was no one identified as homosexual living within that town. And they went there to their view on to get their view on gay marriage, and they were like, yeah, that's all right. I thought it was a really fascinating article. It was like the one town that just the census had no one labeled identifying themselves as homosexual, and then they polled them, and they're like, yeah, that's right, fine, I'm all right. We are going to take a quick break. We will come back and talk about another controversial issue, and that is guns. We will do that with our panel in just a moment. Meanwhile, you can of course join in on the discussion. We'd love to have you. Roundtable at WAMC.org. You can also comment on our webpage or Facebook page or by tweeting us at WAMC Roundtable. We will continue after this short break. It is our roundtable on the roundtable for this Monday morning. Joining us in the discussion, Morning Edition host David Gastina, WAMC newsman Ray Graff, and University at Albany journalism professor and investigative reporter Rosemary Armeo. We welcome your thoughts as well. Roundtable at WAMC.org. You can also comment on our webpage or Facebook page or by tweeting us at WAMC Roundtable. We would love to hear from you. The other big issue, while the Supreme Court is taking up gay marriage, the U.S. Senate is slated to consider comprehensive gun legislation in April, and two very powerful voices on different sides of the gun debate are making news and are getting ready for the showdown. One being the NRA, the National Rifle Association, and their head Wayne LaPierre, and then also in this corner, New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg and his gun group Mayors Against Illegal Guns, which has now said they are going to pour $12 million into advertising in 13 key states to convince potentially persuadable Democratic and Republican senators to vote in favor of gun legislation. And this is really a politician putting his money where his mouth is.
Yeah. Yep. I like that he does that. I would like to be Mayor Bloomberg. He makes a ton of money, and he puts it where he believes it. He plays by the rules, has big impact. You don't even have to agree with him. It's just very cool that he does it.
What I find interesting is it's against illegal guns. Now, many of the GOP, folks on the GOP side, are those that are leery of gun control, have talked about the fact that it's illegal guns we need to get off the street.
Right.
So it almost seems like his position here is in line with everybody that would be seen as the opposite side.
So then why spend the $12 million?
Well, if you get compromise, I guess, and you get others to go along with it, and you can get some illegal guns off the street, that would accomplish his goal.
He's putting his money up against the NRA. They have not had competition before. You have to admire that.
So well, the NRA is clearly not for illegal guns, right? Really?
Okay.
No, I mean, really.
That has been the effect. The NRA, and I would say the worst thing the NRA has done is stop all kinds of research and reporting on gun injuries and gun deaths. We don't know anything, do not know it for the last 12 years, and that's because the NRA has stopped knowledge. It's not a good organization, and I like that Bloomberg is going against them.
I think also, Ray, to your point directly, I mean, the NRA, when they finally came out and made a statement on the Newtown shooting, it was not about the guns. It was not about, you know, it was if the teachers had been armed, this wouldn't have been a problem.
Right.
And it was an odd response. And I think a lot of people, and then when they finally came out with their plan, it was very clear that they were gearing up for a fight.
They're gearing up for a fight against what are right now legal guns. In other words, illegal guns, this is not a this was not the discussion.
Well,
the,
there is some debate as to it, if you look at what is being done in the Senate, and the fact that you know, the assault weapon ban was basically taken off the table, and wasn't allowed to be introduced onto the floor by Harry Reid because he felt it was going to be stomped. Then you're looking at an organization that but by virtue of sort of default is saying, okay, well, we don't want that assault.
Yeah, LaPierre's response to Bloomberg's ad buy was that the mayor was reckless and insane. That doesn't sound like a real reasonable, you know,
well, maybe
response.
He needs some PR coaching. I mean, maybe his message is being garbled. I don't know.
Yeah.
But I am interested in this whole, the illegal gun side of it, because I don't think Ray's out of line here. He's talking about how that's a whole separate issue, right? You know, I've heard many of these arguments about, well, it's the illegal guns. It's not the legal guns we have to watch out for. It's the gun on the street that's got the serial number scratched off and you can get for, you know, $50 in cash or whatever it is.
And like, if you look at Chicago, and was that This American Life that did the piece on
Chicago? Joe had brought that
There
up.
Are so many guns, illegal guns out there, that regardless of whether they ban assault weapons today or ban all weapons today, the guns are there. The cat is out of the bag. And I question whether the mayor's against illegal guns spending $12 million on this is going to have any effect whatsoever.
I also would make the plan is let's give it a shot.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I just want something done. I really do. I hate our namby-pamby representatives who read, goes, well, we're not going to even bring it up because it won't pass. Bloomberg is saying we're going to talk about it. You think there's no good way? Well, let's come up with a plan. What's LaPierre's plan? If this won't work, what will? I haven't heard anything positive yet.
The ads are targeting Republican and Democratic senators in Arizona, Arkansas, Georgia, Indiana, Iowa, Louisiana, Maine, New Hampshire, Nevada, North Carolina, North Dakota, Ohio, and Pennsylvania. So, I mean, those are both red and blue states, and Democrats and Republicans, and this is very much a bipartisan issue.
But let's be clear. The ads are not targeting the lawmakers. They're targeting the people who they... You know, their constituents.
It says they're targeting Senate. I mean, they want people to put pressure on those senators to vote on the floor.
But if you're going to do that, just give the senators the money. In other words, the ads are intended to sway public opinion. They're not intended to sway, you know, this is a two-step process.
Public opinion is pretty much swayed on this issue. And if you're going to give money directly to the senators, then you're going to compete directly with the NRA. And I don't think Bloomberg even has enough money for that.
Well, I don't know. I'm not sure about that.
Well, we haven't checked the balances this morning, but we're going to check in. We're going to take a break and find out what's happening in the world with NPR News. We will be back and talk about another interesting issue having to do with the Washington Post. And they're in a little bit of hot water. And then we'll talk about the NCAA as well. It's all coming up right here on the Roundtable. Welcome back to our Monday edition of Roundtable on the Roundtable. Joining us for the discussion this morning, we have our Morning Edition host, David Gastina. Good morning, David.
Good morning, Joe.
University at Albany journalism professor and investigative reporter Rosemary Armeo joins us. Good morning, Rosemary.
Good morning.
And now the baton has been passed. Ray has handed it off to Ian Pickus, our news director. Good morning, Ian.
Good morning. I think Ray had to get a cup of coffee, and I can understand that.
You're kind.
I think it's better for everyone, yes. We're going to talk about a couple of issues here. Of course, we invite you to do the same. All you have to do is email us, roundtable@wamc.org. We'd love to hear your thoughts on our roundtable on the roundtable. You can also comment on our webpage or Facebook page or by tweeting us at WAMC Roundtable, at WAMC Roundtable, and tweet us or Facebook us or webpage us or email us or however.
Flickr? Do we have Flickr?
Yes. You know, one of these days in our modern technology, I'm going to see the little logo for pin it and not think it says print. Because every time I look at it, I'm like, oh, is that where I print? No, that's not. All right.
Different. Not made for the reading glasses.
No, it's not made for the reading glasses at all.
Pinterest. Yeah, that's one I'm teaching. You know, where the little bulletin boards and you put its picture. Shit, that's it.
Are people still into that right now?
You know, it didn't catch on as much as I thought it was. It's actually, it's being used by a lot of the news magazines, but they're dying too, so who knows?
News magazines and brides.
Brides love it, yeah.
Pinterest.
And recipes, yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's cool. I mean, certainly the options are out there. Although, don't you feel that when you get an invitation to one of these that it's like you're hiring a nanny, you know, you're like, I don't know. I mean, like, sort of like my situation is good now. I don't feel like I should really change. Right. I mean, I've got enough now.
Yeah.
Right. It seems like I'm handling this. I'm doing okay. I don't know if I can take on any more social media. I'm pretty good. Because there is a commitment involved to it.
Yes.
Another thing to check.
Yeah. Another thing to check. And it's, I don't know. I find that interesting. What is talk about some media issues, and this is one probably. I apologize if I'm stealing this from the media project.
Oh, that's fine. We'll get some advanced chance to consider it for the coming show.
Greg Mitchell, author of a recently updated book, "A Media Mistakes During the Run-Up to the Iraq War: So Wrong for So Long," is the name of the book, revealed Sunday night on his blog that the Washington Post Outlook section had killed an assigned piece related to the press debacle that was slated for publication this weekend. Mitchell noted that the Outlook section did run what he calls a misleading, cherry-picking piece by Post media writer Paul Farhi, in which the reporter claims the media didn't fail during the 2002-2003 rush to war. The decision by the New York Post to run Farhi's piece defending the press and not Mitchell's got a lot of attention Sunday morning on Twitter. It was especially noteworthy given that the paper's editorial board, which did help support and was very supportive of President Bush's rationale for invading Iraq, was silent on last Tuesday's 10th anniversary of the start of the conflict. What does this tell us about the New York Post and their editorial board?
Ah, you're looking at me.
I'm going.
Okay. Well, yes. I gotta say, I've read the Mitchell piece. I've read the Farhi piece. I've read the response from the board. And despite the fact that my sister works for the Washington Post and I love to bash and disagree with them, I think the Post was right. I think the Farhi piece was better. It does not say, despite Morton, the way Mitchell portrays it, that it's misleading and cherry picks. It says they did a very bad job, which I think we all agree. No one says we did a good job in the Iraq War now. But there was some excellent reporting. Landry, the McClatchy papers, did amazing reporting, and so did some of the people at the Washington Post themselves. The problem was it wasn't advertised. It wasn't printed on the front page. It wasn't promoted. Their work was put down. But there were reporters doing good reporting. The thing about the Mitchell piece that I love, and of course the glory of social media is now you can see both of them. It doesn't matter if the Post didn't print it, you can still read it, is that he bashes some people who really still have not apologized. And one of them is Thomas Friedman from the New York Times, right, who was a big, stupid, loud proponent of that war, never apologized for it despite the damage. David Ignatius from the Washington Post, yeah, also he has this past week in the 10th anniversary has said, oh, maybe I didn't have it exactly right. But Mitchell's piece is angrier, and so that's kind of more fun to read. But as far as an intelligent piece that looks at what went wrong and how we prevent it, I actually think the Post got it right.
Interesting.
Can I ask, you know, when it comes to, because we use that word apologize for your coverage, you know, I remember having a conversation before he passed with Senator Byrd, and he said, you know, he was one of the three senators that voted against the war,
right.
And said, you know, I don't look, my colleagues, I feel that we were misled. I don't look at myself as better. I don't look at myself as any different. I look at myself as someone who felt that the information that I had was not conclusive enough for me to say it was okay for this country to
go to war. Yeah.
But on the other hand, but that his colleagues who voted for it, he said that they were misled. They weren't bad people. They were misled. I bring that up because, you know, do we need an apology from the journalists who screwed it up? You think we do?
I'm voting yes on that. That's the job of the press, is to protect people when their government is taking action. We have to find out if they're taking the right action. And in this case, except for Jonathan Landry, who I love from the McClatchy paper. Several, Walter Pincus from the Washington Post is another one I would point out. They didn't do what the press does, which is to say, weapons of mass destruction, where? How do you know that? Can you show me that proof again? Basic questions, except for by those few reporters, were not asked.
Well, and
so we're misled because, you know, because people in the administration and the same set of sources that Judith Miller used, that was used by Dick Cheney, we didn't do our job.
And, you know, moving from print journalism to broadcast journalism, ooh. I don't know if you remember this, Joe, but I do distinctly remember, not just as some would stereotype on Fox News, but on all the 24-hour channels, reporters wearing American flag lapel pins and an American flag waving in the corner of the news screen as they're doing the news. That fear, that attack galvanized not only people together under the flag, but it galvanized journalists. And I think it colored their ability to report fairly.
You might also talk about embedding. Remember that little treat to cover the war. We'll let you go and see it really up close and personal. So you end up with all these very young, gung-ho, patriotic, excited, testosterone-laden, whatever the equivalent is for women, reporters who go out who were you know, just went along with it. Like, yeah, we're going to beat the Iraqis. It was like football more than war.
It was shock and awe.
It was a pretty war. Yeah. It was dreadful.
But also, just because you're embedded doesn't mean if you're in the middle of the storm, it's hard to see outside and
correct.
See what's realized. You know, just to see in a greater worldview as to what was happening. And I think that was also a huge issue.
And there were
issue.
Reporters that chose not to be embedded.
Absolutely.
Who chose to go and off they, and report and separately.
That's right. But I think it was a deliberate move by the government to embed people, to put them in the middle so they wouldn't see that bigger picture.
Well, that's the age-old access question.
Yes.
Exactly.
And I don't think, to go back a little, that there's anything wrong with journalists saying, here's what we knew in 2002, here's what we knew in 2003, here's what we know now, and here's how that narrative has changed. There's nothing wrong with accountability because, like the senators taking the vote, the journalists, you know, they knew what they knew at a certain time, and that's bound to change, especially in something as fluid as a war. So people apologizing for the way they wrote about the run-up to the war in 2003, you know, it's not the end of the world to have to apologize for the way you saw it then. And I'm with you. I'm kind of surprised that some of these columnists, especially, you know, Thomas Friedman, who has had as much glory as you can have from the New York Times op-ed page, you know, has not been able to update his view of the Iraq War based on 10 years later.
So let me take...
If only they had cleaned it up a little bit better, it'd be great. That's what we really... And there's more to it. I mean, none of these articles this past weekend mentioned, like, the Jessica Landis story. Do you remember that one?
Yes.
The young woman who was rescued. Well, the story as printed and what really happened were totally different. It was just bad reporting, incomplete reporting, questioned at the time by some people in the publications who ran the Big Hero stories.
Not to mention the football player there that was killed by friendly fire.
Tillman.
Yeah. Wow. So, I mean, there's lots of... We didn't do good reporting. We've covered wars before, and we owed the American people a better job than they got in the Iraq War.
And it seems to be, especially over 10 years, that many... I think tend to wrap it up in a package that is, well, it was a weird time.
Mm.
It was we were coming out of 9/11. It was a strange time, but that's not an excuse, obviously.
No.
Well, and to your point, you know, you were talking about who voted for the war, but I tend to follow Rosemary's line that I'm a bit skeptical about them saying they were given misleading information at the time. I think if we looked at that in context, you could see what direction the Bush administration was going. You could see right away where they were going. And
I think
politicians considered the fear of the country and the American people want to be protected, and I'm getting out of the way of this.
The Americans have a long history in Afghanistan, too, before any of this happened. And no one was asking, like, well, maybe Saddam Hussein is hiding the fact that he doesn't have weapons of mass destruction. He doesn't want the Iranians to know about it. That area of the world, Afghanistan and Iraq, we know a lot about. We didn't use any of that knowledge, I think.
Well, and we mentioned this on the air the other day, where you have somebody like Phil Phil Donahue was on during that time, was on MSNBC before it was cool to be a liberal on MSNBC, and was having people come on every night and saying, look, and this was Phil Donahue's big return to television, look, this doesn't make sense. You know, what we're doing is not right, and really beating that drum, and he was off in 3 months.
Well, nowhere with it, right?
And it was stated explicitly, you're with us. You're against us.
Mm-hmm. Right. And that was true, you know, down to the Senate race in Georgia. I mean, if you had any inkling of being, you know, quote unquote, anti-American or anti the cause, there would be recriminations. And there were, and people, you know, far more powerful people than journalists faced that 10 years ago.
Freedom fries.
Exactly.
I remember...
we should end all segments like that.
Yeah, freedom fries. Phil Donahue did a movie called Body of War, I believe it was.
Thomas Young.
Yeah, and it was a fascinating documentary that he funded and put together. And they had a viewing of it in Woodstock, be shocked. And it was quite an event, and he was there and talking about it. And I went down with my mom. And it was shortly before my mother passed, and she was sitting there with Phil Donahue, and he said, "Well, Eleanor, what are we going to do about this?" And she said, "I don't know. I am so outraged. What do we do?" And he said, "I think you and I can take them on." And she just took his hand and she's like, "Okay, Phil, let's go." And I have this picture of the two of them holding hands, getting like ready to fight the war. I'm like, "All right, there you go."
She reminds me of Mayor Bloomberg.
Yeah.
Let's go.
There you go. We're going to be back in just a moment, talk about the NCAA journey to the Sweet 16. A lot of basketball this weekend. And, Ian watched it all.
I did my very best. And I'm not going to apologize for my coverage of it in 10 years.
We'll talk about that and more coming up next on the Roundtable. Good morning and welcome back to the Roundtable. Here, why don't you take those? Sarah and I are trying to play. All right, those don't work. There we go. That doesn't matter. All right.
These are too loud. What's wrong with your ears?
Okay. They're better now.
Thank you.
We wanted to check in with our social media and find out what's been going on. Sarah LaDuke has been keeping track of that for us.
That's true.
What do we have going on? Let's start with Facebook.
We have a Facebook message from Doug that says, "No clear definition of what an assault weapon is has been offered by the mainstream media, Congress, or the White House. It's not a semi-automatic rifle, which looks like a machine gun, an AR-15 or an AK-47. Since the Firearms Owners Protection Act in May of 1986, ownership of newly manufactured machine guns have been prohibited to civilians. Machine guns which were manufactured prior to the Act's passage are regulated under the National Firearms Act, but those manufactured after the ban cannot ordinarily be sold to or owned by civilians. What changes a semi-automatic AR-15 or AK-47 rifle into a fully automatic machine gun is something called a slide-action stock. They come as an SSA AR-15 or an SSA AK-47 and are easily replaceable of the original stock if one knows what he or she is doing and are currently legal. There ought to be much more press upon banning these to be consistent with current federal regulations."
And then we
have an email from Valerie that says, "As a Unitarian Universalist pastor who once served as a pastor in Oklahoma, I was surprised at how accepting friends and family of gay couples were. I did several unions of couples where, quote, redneck farmers attended and shed a tear at their son or daughter's marriages."
We always love to hear from you. You can email us roundtable@wamc.org. You can also comment on our webpage or Facebook page or by tweeting us at WAMC Roundtable, and know that the first eyes on that post will be those of Sarah LaDuke.
That's right.
Excellent. Sarah, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yes.
Now talk about sports games. Bye.
Now let's talk about sports games. And there were a lot of games over the weekend.
How many
it was
were
a
there?
Huge
42-48, something like that. We're down to 48 games so far.
Wow.
Phew.
So we had a lot of basketball over the last couple of days, and I want to talk about the Sweet 16. Not enough. I want to talk about the Sweet 16 in just a moment, and how we got there. But let us begin where we where we ended last Monday when we had this conversation, and that was over UAlbany. Of course, they were in the tournament. They're in the big dance. They were up against Duke, seeded number two, and the game was Friday afternoon. It was at 12:15, and they were playing in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. And no, they were not victorious. But I'm telling you, I just watched that game and was so incredibly proud of that team. I thought they just did great.
Nice. You know, you have a guy like Jacob Yadi, this little grad student, smallest guy out there, going, you know, head to head with people who are on the way to the NBA, you know, and that, if you're from UAlbany, you have maybe a chip on your shoulder to some extent facing a team like Duke. And then the team embodied that spirit and they didn't win. They kept it close. What makes this so special from my perspective is that another 15 seed, Florida Gulf Coast, whatever that is now in the Sweet 16.
Yeah.
Yes.
And that's what makes this such a democratic, small D, to borrow a line, experiment, is that a team like a 15 could have been UAlbany winning two games. It wasn't this time, but that's what makes it so compelling.
They don't, and Yadi has no chance of getting in the NBA, in your opinion.
I don't think so. I mean, he maybe could play in Europe, but he's going to go into finance. And that's the difference between having a Yadi and having a Mason Plumlee, who's 6'11", and is going to be playing next to LeBron next year.
You know, and it doesn't matter. It really doesn't matter. But it was the fact that the game was always close. It was certainly not embarrassing by any stretch of imagination. And it was just, I thought it was great for the city. I thought it was great for the college, and I thought it was just great for those players and the whole UAlbany community. It was just great.
Likewise, the women's team yesterday
absolutely
almost defeated North Carolina. Never has a 14-1 in the women's tournament. It almost happened. It didn't.
That was a great game.
Yeah, unbelievable. You know,
really fun to watch.
There's no complaints for either UAlbany team as to the performances this weekend in the NCAA tournament. It is, all eyes are on these games. They're huge. You're playing a better team than you've seen all year. And to go out there and both, you know, give a 2 and a 3, everything you have, you can't be anything but proud. Marist women, too, almost took Michigan State down, fell by about 8 points in the end. But great performances, and you get into this time of year, you roll the dice, who knows what happens. Maybe next year Albany will be in the Sweet 16.
Oh, that was what I was going to ask you. What does it look like for next year?
Don't you think Albany could have beat San Diego State?
Yes, I do.
Yeah.
I definitely do.
I thought if that was their pick, you know, that would have been...
If it had worked out differently.
Yeah, if it hadn't been Duke. Yeah. But it was, because I was watching that. I was watching that game, and I thought, you know, they could have done that.
And Duke's not going to lose to a 15 2 years in a row. I mean, the odds of that happening. But
hey,
Gonzaga went down in the second round as a 1 seed, so anyone can beat anyone. That's what makes this so exciting.
The New York Times puts it this way: the round of 16 this week will feature an eclectic mix, the brand names, the underdogs, the overlooked, and the never saw it coming. And that's sort of what you want, right?
Well, you can read Nate Silver break down the bracket odds by odds by odds 2 days before it starts, and then see on the second day of the tournament there's one or two people left in the entire country who did an online bracket who are still perfect after not a fourth of the games the first weekend. It is it's impossible to predict, and it is just so exciting to see a team like LaSalle, which won a national championship 60 years ago and hasn't been this far since, here in the Sweet 16. It's great.
So and now, don't you think, as a sort of a nation, we were talking about this last week, where we want to embrace the underdog, but there's going to be a lot of buys on Florida now.
I want the Big Ten to do well this year.
Big Ten is off to a good start.
Yeah.
Wisconsin went down early, but doing better than the Big East. Georgetown and Pitt are running out of excuses. So the Big Ten was the best conference this year, no doubt about it.
My Philadelphia teams, Villanova, they died. And then Temple gave me Temple.
Temple
was my hope, and then they
but you still have LaSalle.
Yeah, and LaSalle's exciting, so we'll see what happens. It is we always would love to hear from you. Obviously, basketball starts Thursday through Saturday, right? They don't play Sunday because of – am I right on that?
Thursday, Saturday, Friday, Sunday next weekend.
Okay.
It's the same
Excellent.
Schedule with some fewer games.
So we will hear much more about that coming up. Also, we would love for you to contact us, roundtable@wamc.org. You can also comment on our webpage or Facebook page. Tell us what you think of Roundtable on the Roundtable or by tweeting us at WAMC Roundtable. We'd love to hear from you as always. My sincere thanks to our entire crew this morning. Of course, Ray Graff, who stepped out so he can do the news at 10 o'clock. Also, our Morning Edition host, David Gustina. U Albany journalism professor and investigative reporter Rosemary Armeo, and WAMC News Director Ian Pickus. Thank you all for being with us.
Thank you, Joe.
Thank you.